plugged in on the right switch?
It looks to me like we're in business. Now, Sam, would you see if your voice is coming in over there? Let's see if you're picking up.
Yeah. Is it, do you hear me now?
Well, it sure. Now, I believe we're on. I believe we're on the record here, all set to go. It says we're on record. So let's reestablish that this is Sam White. The day's the longest day of the year in 1974, and June 21st or June 22nd. Sam, you came to Alaska originally for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey.
Right.
In what, 1921 or two?
1922.
And you've been written up in several magazines and books.
Yeah.
Gene Potter, were you? No. In what book were you? There was a book.
In this, The Last of the Bush Pilots.
Yes.
Helmrich's
books.
Yeah.
And then you wrote a series of articles that were in the Alaska Sportsman magazine.
Yes.
And when did they appear?
64, from 64 to 65. Those 12 articles that run just a year.
Yes. And those dealt with which experiences mostly?
They dealt with the Coast Geodetic Survey mostly and the Game Commission, the Old Alaska Game Commission.
And then, of course, you flew for yourself. You had your own air service.
For a while, yeah. First, I flew for Weens. After leaving the government game commission, I flew for Weens for 4 years, and then I went on my own. Went on my own in about 45, 40, yeah, 45. And I was on my own until about 1957. Then I went, then the government charters, they petered out, and competition developed so keen that the what few charters that was left over for government, they were too cheap, and they didn't, you couldn't make any money on them, and fellows went broke, and they tried to make up for the low price they bid by padding their logbooks, and I wouldn't have nothing to do with that, so I just quit bidding, and I come home and sat down right here in this chair. First time in a long time too, you know, and I was going to sit her out. I wasn't thinking of retiring, but I was thinking I was going to take one good big rest, and then Ween came along and they sent their bush pilot, their chief bush pilot, Don Holshiser, over to talk me into working for them again. They had, he said they needed some old heads. Too many of their airplanes were getting bent. He said, we got to have somebody who can take them out and do the work and bring them back. Well, that's what way he put it. So I told him I was going to sit for the rest of that month. And so I sat for the rest of that month. Then I went back, checked out with them. And it struck me as an awful cumbersome business. The Ween Airlines had changed in the meantime, you know, and the CAB had taken a bigger role. And the Civil Aeronautics Inspection Service was different. And the I was days and days checking out down there. One day we go down, sit around all day, and I couldn't get an airplane. They were out working. And then the next time I go down, something else would come up, and we'd maybe get one flight. It took several days to check me out, and with the interference we had, and complying with the regulations and everything. You see, they were on a subsidy And they were an airline, and they had to observe every one of them. If they violated, they could serious consequences. They could be fined heavily, or they could lose something, you know. So they was pretty careful to do everything right. And it took quite a while just to find out if I could fly. Of course, they knew I could, but they had to prove it to the government, you know.
They had to prove it on paper.
Yep, that was it. They had to do it on paper.
Well, now, Sam, you originally were born in Maine, weren't you?
Yep.
And tell me, where were you born?
I was born on a side hill farm 6 miles from Eustace, Maine, which had inhabitants of... It had a population of about 75 people in the village. And it was a dead-end road right there. It stopped right there. And we were 6 miles beyond on another dead-end road, right up against the forest. And we was about 25 miles from the Canadian border. And that was all woods, all wilderness then. Lakes and rivers and streams, you know. And we had to work real hard. There was 10 kids in the family, you know, and then we always had a neighbor's kid or two around, you know, and then oftentimes I was over around the neighbors too, you know, eating off of their grub pile. We drifted back and forth. Everybody was very hospitable in those days, you know. Any stranger come along, didn't matter. The first thing you asked him was if he was hungry, you know, whether it was mealtime or not, because some people would come when it wasn't mealtime and they was hungry, they had missed one or two meals, you know. So we used to feed them, and they used to feed us, and go out and shoot a deer. That was our meat supply mostly, was shooting the deer, you know. There was a lot of them in those days, and they did a lot of damage to our crops, but they made up for it by furnishing meat to our horse. And whenever we shot a deer, why, the neighbors got their share of that. We shared them. We had no refrigeration, so they had to be used up right quick. Of course, a family of 10 or 12 people, you know, deer didn't last too long. I was 12 years old when I shot my first deer.
How did you leave Maine?
I left Maine... I was guiding on the Meganic Fish and Game Club. They had 180,000 acres on the Maine side of the line and another 180,000 on the Canadian side of the line. They had cabins at 10 or 12 different lakes, and they had a big clubhouse at one lake in Canada. And I was guiding for them, and I also guided for another sporting camp, Blakesley Lake outfit, you know. And I started in on this Blakesley Lake business, and then I went over to the, when I proved I could do it, I went over to the Meganic Fish and Game Company. And it was a wilderness then, you know. They had their camps in those places, and it was composed of very wealthy people. And I mean very wealthy, like Ike Cokefair, a big jewelry outfit, you know, and Tiffany's, and American Woolen Mills, and the American Optical Company, King Brothers. Oh, brother, there were some big shots in that outfit. And they were nice people, you know, and nice to work with, you know, to guide for. And they had good fishing in those days, and real good hunting too, you know. There was no moose in those days back there, only a scattering one once in a while. Now they've got 6,000 or 8,000 moose in the state. They've clamped the season down and protected them vigorously, you know, and they came back. They got a lot of moose there now, and they don't dare open the season now, because if they did, New York and Philadelphia would flock in there and kill them off probably all in one hunt. they keep them closed. They're very jealous of those moose. And they're not like the moose up here. They're smaller. A big one back there would probably weigh, a big bull would probably weigh 1,000 pounds.
How big will our moose up here run?
Well, I've seen them go to 1,800 pounds.
You have?
Yeah, when they're fat in the fall. Great big, and they got bigger antlers too, you know.
Well, let's see. You went to work, that was the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey, which brought...
I went to work first with the International Boundary, right there.
Oh, I see.
They came through there. That was my first stepping stone. They came through there and surveyed out the boundary right through them club grounds, right between the club grounds, you know, between Canada and Maine. And I could see that the guiding business was dwindling, you know. That is, it wasn't a thing to tie to. And besides, I wanted to do some things, you know. I didn't want to be tied down to guiding all my life. And so I applied for a job with the International Boundary Survey. And I applied for a job of chainman because that paid $55 a month. And that looked good to me. So anyway, I got a letter from the boss, and he said, if you want a job as axeman for $45 a month, you can go to work on the 1st of May.
Now, Sam, when was this?
About 1915. Yeah.
And about how old were you then?
24, 25. Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, it was the year, I guess the 16th, it was the year they called the National Guard out and sent them down to Mexico. And there was a fellow, he was a lieutenant in the National Guard, his name was Boots. Or we called him Boots. Anyway, I remember him quite well. And he was a foreman. And he had had no experience, apparently, with Canadian Frenchmen, and that's what most of the ex-crew was. And there were about 35 men, you know. So he wasn't getting along too well with them. So I had been working there just a month when the National Guard was called out, and he was a lieutenant in the National Guard, and he was called back. So I got his job, and that paid $75 a month. Boy, I was in the cream then, you know. $75 a month, that's good money back then in those days. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the wintertime, I went with log hauling. But I worked for the International Boundary 2 or 3 years, and let's see now. 1 year after I came back from overseas,
you went to Cuba, was it, or where did you go overseas?
France.
To France, I
yeah,
see.
Western Front. I came back. I worked for them 1 year, the International Boundary, and that completed the boundary work. Right down to Eastport, Maine. We worked in Eastport Harbor there on monuments and locating the line where the channel was, you know. And then the next summer, it was 1921. No, the next summer was, I didn't work for the government that summer. That was 1919, I worked down there at Eastport. 1920, I worked Champlain Railway Company, on a survey of homesteads back down in Vermont. They bought a block of 400 or some odd homesteads, all in one block, you know, for timberland. And it was the title went back to the King of England, and we had to survey out each separate one of them lines, you know, between them homesteads. It was a very interesting job. It was a grant that was given to some big shot in colonial days, you know, before the revolution. And then he had to settle so many people on that land to retain his title to that land, you know, and a lot of other ground that went with it. So he wound up with twice as much ground as anybody else had, you know. Yeah. He was a very wealthy person in those days. So we had to establish them lines and trace them titles right back to the King of England, colonial days. And on two or three of those lots, the houses, the original houses, still stood. And there was pine boards in them. You know, from the old growth pumpkin pine, a prehistoric pine, it was boarded in them 5 feet wide.
My word.
And beautiful. They were pine, you know. They were beautiful boards. They was covered with they was in the walls, you know, covered with paper on the inside and an outside wall on the other side of the beams. So they didn't weather at all, or they didn't deteriorate in any way.
Huge trees.
And they were planed and smooth, and we just, oh, they was beautiful to look at, you know, them big boards. Well, there was still many, in those days, there were still many of those pines growing through Maine and other parts of New England. They didn't grow in a solid forest. They grew in groups of anywhere from 15 to sometimes 100, you know. And you could see them for miles away over the tops of the other trees. They were, up to 160 feet tall, and they were up to 10 feet on the stump. Huge big things, you know. Beautiful pine. And there were no limbs on them, so you get way up to the top. So they made wonderful lumber, because there was no knots in them, you see. They made wonderful lumber, and I don't suppose there's any of them left in Maine now. There was when I left there, there was a good many isolated groups of them left, but they're
gone. Well, after you completed the boundary survey there in, or worked on that, was that when you came to Alaska?
No, I went to the next year with the Coast Geodetic. They transferred me to the Coast Geodetic. And I went to the Colorado River, 1921. Mm-hmm. And we surveyed surveyed down through the Santa Fe Desert, Glen Canyon, and on down to Lee's Ferry, Arizona, which is on the bank of the river. And that's where I run the canoe through Glen Canyon, you know, and got away with it.
There was no danger.
It was just like paddling on any ordinary river, except the river was awful muddy. And I don't know if a fella couldn't hardly swim in it, you know, because you get that water splash in your face, and you could feel that grit in your eyes, you know, it would do you in pretty quick. And there were rattlesnakes. Oh boy, the rattlesnakes all over everything. And you have that record of the hole in the wall, the San Juan. I just told you that yesterday.
No, you didn't. You were telling me about, yesterday you were telling me about the trip up the Good Pasture.
Oh, yeah. Well, that you didn't get.
So I didn't,
But I was thinking you got that.
No, I never got anything on the hole in the wall. That was somebody else you told that to. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, what happened, the Mormon fathers, you see, when they crossed the Colorado, they tried the crossing of the fathers, and some of them got across there. And, at Hall's Crossing, that was the crossing of the fathers, and that the walls come down low there, and they could get across there, but beyond there it was a little bit out of the way, too lengthy, and I guess rough country, sandstone mountains to go through. So they came down the San Juan River in boats, which solved a serious problem of transportation for them, and they crossed the Colorado onto the west side. And then it was 10 miles from there up to the hole in the wall. And they built a road up there. And there was rocks the size of this house in that road. And they blasted them out of there. But they didn't have no powder and they didn't have no dynamite. They built stacked driftwood around them, heated them hot, and then threw cold water on them, and the rocks would shatter. And they had a passable road. They had a good road, 10-mile road there from the San Juan, mouth of San Juan, up to Hole in the Wall. And then they left a young man and his family there at the Hole in the Wall. They built a stone house for him. And the Hole in the Wall was a narrow opening, probably 20 feet wide or something like that, with canyon walls going straight up. Real high, probably 800 to 1,000 feet, and inside of that there was probably 30 acres of flat ground inside of that, you know, with grass and water, nice clear water coming out of the sandstone. Oh, there's a beautiful spot in there, hole in the wall. I may be wrong on the size of it, but I'm sure it was all 30 acres in there.
And they farmed that?
No.
They didn't park.
That was just en route.
I see.
That was why they could get out of the canyon. They went through this hole in the wall, and they had room to operate up in there, that 30 acres flat land, you see, and grass and everything, and feed for their stock, which they wouldn't have had down on the river. And then they had a 700-foot vertical wall, straight up and down, sandstone, nothing growing on it. And they took the whole outfit, oxen, horses, wagons, and everything, all of their farming implements and everything, right up that stone wall with block and tackle. And they had, you could see the, where the ropes had cut into the lip of the sandstone up at the top. It looked like it had cut into it a foot or two, you know.
Now, Sam, when had they done that?
Well, I haven't got the date.
In the 1800s?
Yeah.
They were following Joseph Smith on the westward run of the Mormons.
To Salt Lake City.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw this place when you were there?
Oh, yes, I saw that. I was right there under it, and I was overawed by those, where those ropes had cut into the sandstone, you know, pulling up their wagons and their stock. They had to take the people up that way, too, you know.
Sure.
And people, they had to walk that way on the rope.
Well, then from Arizona, you went back to Louisiana, was it?
No, from Arizona, I went back to Maine. And then in 22, I came up here. May 1922. Well, they stayed 5 years up here. They stayed 4 years up here and operated, and then I stayed 1 year later and did reconnaissance for another season. But they took off and left Alaska, and they didn't come back till the 40s. And I went out with them and worked pretty near a year, not quite. And I worked in Minnesota and Iowa. And then I went down to New Orleans for the winter. Well, that New Orleans is what did it. And when I went out, I stopped at Juneau and went up to see the Alaska Game Commission. They had just been organized, you know. They had just been put into business there. And they didn't know a thing about this interior country. And I had all these maps. And everywhere I saw sheep and moose and caribou, which is pretty much all over, I recorded it on those maps. And they didn't know nothing about that, you know. They didn't know whether there was sheep or whether there was anything else, only just in the main ranges. So I had that recording on those maps, and I went up to the Game Commission office, and I left them maps with them. And they were just a year old then, and they hadn't gotten beyond the starting stage, you see. So they went over those maps, and a year later they wired me for work for them.
Well, then it was in 22 or so that you came up.
Yeah.
And now you came to Fairbanks or where at that time?
I came to Anchorage first 2 years, and then I...
Oh, you did. Now, what did you do that first 2 years in Anchorage?
Coast survey, triangulation survey work, and we were coming this way. And we, in 1923, we got here.
Well, now, you did that first work out of Anchorage. You were on foot?
Horses. We didn't ride. We had about 30 horses to pack our outfit.
Where did you go that first year that you were up here?
We started in on Cook Inlet and came straight up through east of the railroad.
Whereabouts on Cook Inlet were you? Did you start?
Anchorage.
At Anchorage.
Yeah.
I see. Now, you didn't go down to the mouth of Cook Inlet.
No.
You started at Anchorage.
No, we started in, there was a known azimuth station, which was very accurately located there near Anchorage, and they started out from that. And then we carried that scheme on up through till we got to Fairbanks here. Not along the railroad, we was back in the mountains away from the railroad, you know, where the mountains were higher. We came across the... We touched the railroad fairly close at Broad Pass, because we had to have a baseline there. And the measured distance of the baseline from Anchorage to Broad Pass was 2 inches different than the computed distance. Now, wasn't that something?
Pretty good in those days.
Yeah, I don't know, over 2 years, you know. Well, they measured them baseline with a tape of very special metal. It had a very low expansion rate and changes of temperatures, you know, or contraction either. And they also took a temperature at each end of the tape every time they stretched it, and they put, they had a scale, and they put just so many ounces of tension on that tape every time they stretched it. And that's the way, then they couldn't compute the distance in the field because it was too complicated with all them temperatures, you know. Every time you stretch that tape, you had a temperature adjustment.
Of course, contraction or expansion.
Yeah, at each end of the tape. The tape was 500 feet long.
Well now, Sam, how many were in your party when you began from surveying out of Anchorage?
It was about 30 hours.
And that was a preliminary reconnaissance?
I was doing the reconnaissance ahead, and the others followed me. I laid out the trails, selected the stations, and they followed me. And I marked the stations, too, with a disc, a bronze disc, cemented into a stone.
How did you pick your trail?
Oh, just go where you can take horses without bogging them down, or... Which was an awful job, you know, and I had to do it fast because they were right behind me. But I made it. I'd done it all right. We lost one horse.
How would you select a site like that, where to put these discs?
On a high point, that would see high points back and high points ahead. Certain ones, not just any old high point. Each one had to see another. And they had to make a triangle that was, a quadrangle. And then you would figure out the strength of that figure. Now, if you had angles that were obtuse, they were weak. But if you had angles that were fairly square, you know, they figured out to a certain strength. And you figure them out, and if they come within the limitations, that's why you put the station.
Now, was the railroad in there at that time?
The railroad was in and operating, but a narrow gauge from Fairbanks to Chattanooga, from Nenana to Fairbanks. It was narrow gauge from Nenana at that time
to
Fairbanks.
Oh, I see. Well, now, but the rail bed had been built, and,
yep.
And so why did you not follow the rail bed at that
time?
Well,
the railroad was too low. And we couldn't get high enough mountains.
So you went to the east.
Yeah, it could have been done, but still, it wasn't. It
now,
wasn't.
How high were some of the peaks that you picked?
6, 7 feet.
No, for the tops, what were the elevations of some of the peaks then that you would set your copper, your bronze marker?
They would be 6, 7 feet. Some of them above sea level. And some of them would be, in some cases where we had a good network and we could see down, we'd have some of them down to 2,000 feet, you know.
I see. 6,000-7,000 feet.
Yeah.
I see. Well, that's kind of rugged country in there. You were really doing a bit of mountain climbing, weren't you?
Oh, I was climbing mountains every day.
I mean, you were just walking over tundra and muskeg and...
Yeah, yeah.
You were doing mountain climbing.
And I had six horses assigned to my party to pack the paraphernalia, you know, and everything, and grub. And then I had four dogs with me, because when I went up on the mountains where we couldn't take the horses, I had to have something to pack the paraphernalia to get up on top of the mountain. And at Windy Mountain, I got stalled up there on top of the mountain. And I had to wait overnight where I could dare move. I see what was happening. I got onto a flat place where it rained and froze. And there was a quarter of an inch of the slickest ice you ever see on everything. Well, you could no more go up a grade or down a grade, you know, you'd be just like a toboggan. So I found I see what was happening before it got acute. I found a bowl on the side of the mountain. I got into that, and I had these four dogs with me, and there were bears all over the country too, you know, then in those days, grizzly bears, some of them were kind of mean. I had a mountain tent with me, I had to pitch that because it was drizzling, you know, and freezing. And I pitched that, and then I was afraid the dogs would leave me because they were miserable out in that drizzle, you know, so I called them inside the tent. And when the last one came in, it just, that tent was bulged. Yeah, it was just a room horse, that was all. And they were laying on top of each other and alongside of me, you know, and crowding. And they'd get settled down, one dog would move, and the others would growl at him. So after a while, they settled down. And I thought, what a dumb, fine thing now if a grizzly bear come along, and he just give us that stuff and roll us down the mountain. But it didn't. I had to wait till noon the next day before that ice melted off, because there was a rock that was very steep, you know, that Windy Mountain was very steep. And rock slides there, you know, and them rocks would roll and you'd walk on them. Oh gosh, it was sure scary. And very steep.
That's up by Carlo Creek, isn't it? Is that
I don't remember that name, Carlo Creek. The thing, the creek that I remember there is Brush Kavanaugh.
Oh, Brush Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
Yes, I heard of that.
Yeah.
So that was really a stormy area for you when you were there, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, how about going west of the railroad? Did you get over into that Dutch Hills
well,
area?
We straddled the railroad when we got to McKinley Park, because we got some figures there that would fit better in the country by straddling the railroad, you know. And then we used the Rudd River Buttes and the Clear Creek Buttes and Monument Point down here and brought it right into Fairbanks. And then we had another baseline here at Fairbanks, with the same result as the other. It was really good, just computed difference, just an inch or so different than the measured distance of the baseline, which is very excellent. Then the Coast Survey pulled out of Alaska.
Now, that was all for map making?
No, that was preparation for map making.
That's what I mean, though. That was
precise triangulation for control work when they come to make the maps. Starting point. Each triangular station was a starting point for topographic work.
I see.
Either that or from pictures taken from the air, from airplanes, you know. You've got to have control.
That really was the beginning of the mapping of Alaska.
Yeah, that was the beginning.
For topographic mapping.
Yep.
Well, now, I've seen some pictures that you had where you were with a bunch of horses crossing a big river.
Yeah.
I thought you were over in the McKinley Park area somewhere.
Well, we came through there.
But you were down on the Talkeetna River going through, too.
We crossed the Talkeetna and the Montana Creek and all of them that flowed that way, you know, across the Susitna. That is the headwaters of the Susitna drainage. Then there's the Shawitna and the Chenelna and on up this way.
Was there anybody in there doing any prospecting when you came through?
Yes. Oh, Moose John down at Talkeetna, one of the old...
Yes.
There were several of them Moose Johns, you know.
Oh, were there?
But he was one of them, and boy, what a character he was. He was prospecting. He really meant business, too.
Is that right?
Yeah, and he was a character, too. We named a mountain after him down there, a triangulation station. Named it Moose, you know, because he... And that done that man more good than if you'd have given him, put $1 million in the bank for him.
Oh,
that
darn.
Really set him right up in business. He thought I was a wonderful guy, you know. I would recognize him to the extent of naming a station after him.
Now, you called the station Moose.
Yeah.
You didn't call it Moose John.
No, we called it Moose.
But anybody that would see that would think you'd named it after a moose. You wouldn't. They
probably
wouldn't know you'd named it after a man.
Very likely, but that didn't.
But that was
him.
The case. You named it for Moose John.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about him. Can you remember his whole name by any chance? Or?
No, I don't know what his name was. I don't know if I ever did know. But that's what we called him.
He was a miner there, a prospector at.
He was there. Let's see. What creek was he on now? I can't remember the name of that creek, but he had rubies and garnets that showed that it was an ore that showed there was plenty of silver in there somewhere, and there was also gold. And he was very enthusiastic about it, but it's never developed into anything yet. And of course, he's long gone. He was an old man then, you know. And he was very, very appreciative of having been recognized.
Of course, sure.
Yeah.
And how about, were there many others in there?
Not too many. Yeah, there was, and I can't remember the name, there was two others that I remember. One of them was a little bit of a dried up man, you know. He looked like he was dehydrated, probably weighed 110, 20 pounds. And he was an old man, heavy head of hair, and a mustache had come out and drooped way down. Snow White. And he had his rifles all fixed up. He had two rifles, a 22 and a bear gun. And he had them fixed up with a finger stall on the muzzle, you know, fastened to. So I fixed mine up the same way. It was the best deal I ever see. To protect the muzzle of your gun. When you want to shoot, all you got to do is slip it off and go to shoot and see. And I've still got it on the gun.
But it keeps stuff from getting in the barrel?
Yep.
I see.
And you could maybe drop the gun and strike muzzle first. Wouldn't get hurt. Even if it fell on a rock, it wouldn't get hurt. Use heavy leather, you know.
Sure.
It was a real good deal, and one or two people have copied it up here from me, but I don't claim that I originated it, because I like to give that old fella credit for that, you know. That's one of the things I picked up in this country from the old timers. And practically everything that I, all the skills that I use in this country, you know, most of them come from the old timers that are already here. Until I got into aviation, of course, they had nothing.
Then you had to start innovating on your own.
Yeah.
Then you were an old timer making up.
Yeah, and by that time.
Well, Sam, you came on up and you surveyed that area. Were there any particular incidents that occurred?
Oh, well, every day.
Every day?
Every day.
What sort of thing would happen?
Oh, 10,000, 100,000 caribou would come along. And we'd have to get the horses into a bunch. They wouldn't turn out for us, you know. Solid masses of them. So we'd locate some obstruction if we had time, like a pile of rock. And we'd get the horses in behind that, and we'd be there with them, you know, holding on to those that were skittish. Or we'd get a pile of brush or some trees, you know, anything we'd get behind. Well, the caribou went on by you. And we'd be in the middle of that herd for maybe 10-15 minutes while they were going by. And they'd sometimes be going by within 50 feet of us, you know, or even less. And it was altogether possible that some of them antlers might hook into a strap or something, you know, and cause a consternation. We could hear them coming, you know, before we even see them sometimes. If they was in the hilly country, we could hear their hoofs and a rumbling, you know, and that clickety-clack that a caribou would make when he walks. So them were incidents, and bears, of course. We had lots of bears incidents, and they'd scare the horses and bears. And we'd bluff the bears out. We didn't have to kill many of them. I killed three of them at different times. But the first bear fight was on Peters Creek. There was a concentration of grizzly bears in there because it was a favorable spot. There was lots of food there for them, skunk cabbage and bulbs and roots and things that they liked, and pocket squirrels and rabbits and rock rabbits, you know, thick in there. And groundhogs, and the bears are concentrated right in that valley. They're kind of protected, because there wasn't many people in the country shooting bears then. And there were some big ones in there, and I walked in between old sow and a cubs one day, and I was right in front of her before I see them, you know. I'd just come up over a ridge and out from behind an outcropping, and I walked right in between her and the cubs. Well, things started happening awful fast there, and I had no choice but to kill her. I hated like the devil to do it. She was a big bear, but it had to be done. And I got it.
It would have been you or her.
Oh, yeah.
Possibly wouldn't, because she took right after me with the most awful roar, you know, and chomping my jaws, you know. And
she was really coming after you?
Oh, yeah, she come right at me. She was, I dropped her, the last time I dropped her about 30 feet away, maybe 20 feet, something like that. Right close up. And she meant business. Because she figured her cubs were in danger. If she'd have run around me, she'd have been all right.
Sure, of course.
The cubs wouldn't have been threatened at all, you know, but they don't know.
They don't know.
Well, there was incidents like that, you know, and then one day we, I had a dog, and he had a mosquito. I had four dogs with me, and one of them was especially vulnerable to the mosquitoes for some reason. I don't know. They used to make his eyes sore. They'd bite him all around the eyes and the nose and the lips, you know. The others didn't seem to mind it so bad. So I used to take him under the bed net sometimes, you know, on the, I'd let him sleep on a mat at the foot of the bed net. Well, one day he fixed it so he didn't get under the bed net anymore. And he was, when I was, when I was pitching the bed net, you know, he was trying to get under it right quick as he could, you know. He got so he knew about that. One day he was under the bed net and a pocket squirrel run by the tent. Here goes my bed net down the mountainside with a dog inside of it after a pocket squirrel. But I had a spare, so when I saved what was left of the old one. But he had to sleep outdoors after that. He never got into the tent even anymore.
That was a tremendous experience.
Yeah, it was.
To do that early
game, it was game all over everything, yes. You know. It was sheep, flocks of sheep. 75 was not unusual.
Is that right?
To see in a bunch, even 50 rams in a bunch, you know. And right down there by Healy, Moody Creek. You'd see up to 50 rams in a bunch. They weren't hardly molested. There was just a few people there. And the people didn't get back very far into the hills, you know. They could get their sheep meat right there, right close to the railroad track, while I go stomping off into the hills. So the sheep was not molested. And caribou, hundreds of thousands of them. Never be like that again. Couldn't possibly...
Yeah. Now, did you get off, take any tangents or side trips off of your north-south route to establish?
Oh, yeah, we had to go on to both sides of the quadrangles, you know. Yeah, the quadrangles was, in some cases, they ranged from 7.5 miles wide to 30 miles wide.
I see.
And we had to cover both sides.
Did you ever have any trouble with the horses crossing the rivers?
Well, yeah, I suppose to be called trouble today. We'd herd them into the river, and there was always one that would strike across, you know, and the others would follow. One of the worst rivers we crossed was the Sheep River there at Talkeetna, above Talkeetna. That's why the Talkeetna and the Sheep came together. And it was deep and it was swift, not too wide. They had a cable across with a carriage on the cable, and we shoved our packs over on that. But we had to go up and find a shallow spot for a man to get across, to get on the other side and operate that pulley. And that was kind of a chore. We made it though. One guy made it, I think it was me, I went across. And I had, I lost the cable, the cable fouled up with the carriage right in midstream one. And the doggone thing tipped over. And I lost my war bag in, I had my army discharge in it. But the next day we found it on a bar down below, so I didn't lose it, but it got awfully damaged, of course.
And, of course, you were a little alarmed there for a while.
Yeah, I sure
thought
was.
You would have lost it. Yeah.
Yeah, and we made it, and then we crossed that, and then right immediately after we crossed that, we had to cross the other river. We crossed the Talkeetna and then the Sheep, and they were both not too... Well, the Sheep, Which one comes first now? I've forgotten.
I don't know.
Well, doesn't matter. They were only about a mile or two apart there where we crossed them. One of them we crossed and rode the horses across because they didn't have to swim. We found a gravel bar that where the river was spread out enough to make it shallow. Then we left about $1,000 worth of grub on the cache. We built a cache and a very good one up in a tree, you know, and we armored it so that we thought nobody, nothing could climb it. And we had pretty close to $1,000 worth of grub up there, you know, at Alaska prices. And that the Wolverine got up in there.
Is that right?
Threw everything down.
Oh, no.
Yeah, threw everything down on the ground, and just what he couldn't eat and get away with, he fouled it up so nothing could eat it. You know?
Nothing in the world could eat it,
even in a starving condition. And all that was left was a sack of flour. He'd thrown it off the platform, and it was rolled up in a very tough artillery top. And I guess he got tired out doing his other mischief, you know, by that time, and it wedged in the branch, between the tree and the branch, halfway down, and he left it there. So that was a sack of flour. Two men came along, one of them lived in Alaska, Dan Gray of Anchorage, or Wasilla, rather. He was a real good man, and he knew the hills. And then we had another fellow by the name of Cornell. He was a young fellow. And he had lots of courage, and he was from Washington, Oregon, I forget where. He was a young fella, and they had to live on that sack of flour and blueberries and bear meat for a month. And they did it. Yeah, and they completed their work. They were a real set of light keepers, you know. And they came along behind the others, see.
What does a light keeper do?
He showed the lights that the observing party observed on.
I see, I see. They, for the triangulation.
Yep.
He told a light for them to see it.
Yep, the light, well, the light was set on a stand that was weighted down with rocks, and it was this mark, bench mark, was right under the stand. And the light had to be centered right over the center of that pinpoint. It couldn't be a 32nd of an inch off, because if it was, it would be wrong, see, that close. And to get this thing so fine, they took 32 bearings on every light. They would take 16 bearings going around to the right, and then they would take 16 bearings going back to the left, see, reverse the whole instrument. And then they would take the mean of those, all those bearings. And even just one bearing, you know, you would think it would be accurate enough for anything, but it wasn't for them. They got 32 times and then take the mean results of that. And the circle, the entire circle at that, at any station, had to close within 3 seconds.
Well, that's...
And a second, it subtends 1 foot in 40 miles. So you can see how that...
Sure, well, I guess that was the foundation, yep, of the mapping system. It, that was great.
And then every 100 miles or so, 150 miles, they put in an azimuth station in the big concrete block. They used to have one right down here at the railroad, right by near, somewhere near the roundhouse. We tried to find it here a few years ago, and apparently they've torn it out of there. The railroad men and the road commission, they don't, their men don't have any inkling of how much it costs to put them stations in and how important they are. And they tear them, if they come to them and they're in their way, they just tear them right out, just like they lose any other obstruction, you know. They think nothing of it. They destroy what is very valuable and what costs a lot of money to obtain.
Through the years, did you ever have any other encounters with Wolverine?
Yeah, I shot several of them. There was the biggest, there was lots of Wolverine in Broad Pass in those days, you know. And... Oh, they ruined several camps for us, you know. They, one time at Montana Creek, the pack had left to take care of his horses. He was gone 2 hours and a half. The two light keepers were out, and I was out ahead doing reconnaissance. The camp was left unattended for about 2 hours and a half. And we come back and the thing was a wreck. The tent was hanging in ribbons on the on the pole, and the grub was all out front and all mixed up in one big pile and fouled up, you know, so nothing could eat it. And then we were living on the country, and even the salt was gone and the sugar. And we lived on rabbits and ptarmigan for 2 weeks solid. And we got kind of weak and tired on that, you know. But we got the work done. It was the end of the season, and we were there, and we'd be going out in 10 or 12 days, and we didn't want to leave anything on. We wanted it tied up just right. So we stayed, and we rustled grub. We found a cache or two, nothing in them. Well, we'd borrowed that grub off anybody at that time. But on the way out, when the observers, we all congregated right there at that particular spot, because I was the guy that would locate the trail for all of the outfit to go out on to the railroad, see? And we all congregated right there, about 25, 30 men. And by that time, the party got a little smaller, and we'd lost a few horses. Everybody was out of grub. We had nothing. And we was rustling grub, you know, ptarmigan, rabbits, and anything that showed up, you know. And that number of men, it takes quite a lot of grub. So we come onto a cache, finally, on the way out. Pretty big cache. A.A. Schonbeck of Anchorage. You probably heard of him. And we went up in the cache. It was well stocked. He'd been prospecting up there and mining. So we took what we needed and cataloged it, left a paper in the cache, and took it on along with us to give to him, you know, in Anchorage, and had a copy for himself. And we took quite a little bit of grub there. Took it down to Anchorage and contacted Mr. Schonbeck, and he wouldn't take a thing. He says, you don't even have to put the grub back. He says, I'll take care of the whole works. He says, you fellows are out of grub. I thought that was a pretty darn good monument for him, you know. He was really an Alaskan, all right.
Well, he could afford it, and he knew you needed it.
Yeah, he knew he wasn't stealing, you know.
That's right. There's sure a lot of difference.
Yeah. So whatever they say about that, Schonbeck, A.A. Schonbeck, I think he was quite a man. Quite an Alaskan myself.
Well, now let's see. What was his name that was the Baron of the Railroad?
At that time, let's see, who was it that...
Cap Lathrop, let's see. Where was he at that time?
He was at Healy. He was operating at Healy, opening up the coal mine, you know.
That's right. He was in the coal there, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Now
I can't remember head of the railroad was at that time, but I should. I knew him all right. And they had several in my day, you know. Colonel Olson for one. I think Steese. Steese was another one. No,
he was with the highway division.
He was with the highway, yeah. Johnson.
Was it Johnson then?
There was a Johnson.
Yes, there was a Johnson. He was there when we came to Alaska in 49.
That was another Johnson.
This was a different Johnson before him.
49.
Yeah, I think there was another Johnson in the 20s there. Because I was a little later. Sam, what year was this now? This was what, 23, 24, 24, you said?
23 when I got here.
Well, it was 22 that you were doing that first survey out of Anchorage.
Yep.
And then, did that take you 2 summers?
No, that took us 1 summer. Then we were working this way, see. Mm-hmm. the second summer, we got as far with the triangulation as Healy. And I got as far as Wood River with the reconnaissance.
As Wood River?
Yeah.
Well, now, which Wood River was that?
Right down here, down the 10, just
I
a little
see.
Way.
I
Wood
see.
River Buttes. That was one point. I got that far.
I see.
And then the next summer, the whole outfit took off the States that fall, and they were gone. They never come back, you see.
Let me ask you a question. When you would go through as the advanced man, how would you mark the place so that the party following behind you would know where you had started?
Oh, trees. I'd blaze trees where there was trees. And where there wasn't trees, I would pile up stone cairns, you know, and put a... And sometimes we packed a few sticks with us, and we'd stick them into these cairns, you know, and have a flutter flag tied on the top of the stick. Always stick. It didn't have to be big in your thumb, you know. And that's the way we marked the trails.
Hmm. Well, that was a tremendous experience. It would have been pleasurable, and there would have been sort of the element of ordeal in it at times when you ran out of grub.
We was three seasons getting up here, yeah. The season of 23, we terminated down somewhere near Broad Pass. In the season of 24, we terminated out here down by near Healy. Season of 23, the second season, in August, we was opposite Curry, way back in the mountains. And I had come out to Curry and cruised a trail and marked it. And a lot of it was above timber, and they were cairns. And before I could go back to the outfit, they were about 30, 40 miles back in the mountains. It snowed. And I mean it snowed. It snowed for several days. It came 26 inches of snow up in the hills, and then it didn't even clear up, and then it snowed again right on top of that. And then there came a blizzard. And the observing party was way back on the far side of the scheme, and they lost 8 horses the night of the blizzard, first night of the blizzard. The horses just took off, and they never see them again. There was no chance of tracing them, you know, because the snow just blowed in the blizzard. You couldn't see from here across the street. So I realized I had to get back. That trail that I made going out for them was no good. That was in August. So I started out to go back, and I couldn't make it alone. I discovered that the first day out. So I went back and got the other two members of the party that was out on the railroad with me. One of them was the chief engineer, and the other one was my packer that packed the outfit. And we went back together.
Now, why couldn't you make it alone?
I couldn't break trail and keep going. The snow was... I'd sink to my knees.
And you didn't
snowshoes.
Have snowshoes?
Yes, I did have
You did have snowshoes?
Yeah.
And you still went through the snow?
Yeah, right. Well, it didn't go clean to the bottom, but it was such heavy going that one man couldn't hope to get there, you know. So I went back and got them other two fellas, and they went with me, and one of them had never been on snowshoes before. And that was the engineer, but he was game. And we went to Timberline the first night, first day, and we camped under a tree. I've got a picture of that. And then the next day we took to this open ridge, and that's when the blizzard hit. We had to go up this open ridge. And getting up onto that ridge on the other end was a cliff, and there was only one way up. And it was just vertical, you know, very rough. And only one way up there for a mile or two. And so that was the only way to go down. And I just wondered how we were going to find that trail down in that blizzard, you know. And we managed to keep our direction all right going up going up on that ridge. We had about 7 or 8 miles to go on that ridge we got up there, and I decided we was opposite that cliff where we had to go down, because there was where we were going to hit my trail, where it terminated in the timber, and before I went up onto the ridge. So we got out there to where I figured we couldn't see nothing, you know. And we were walking, almost treading on each other's tails on the snowshoes, because if we got 20 feet away, we couldn't see each other. And we were in desperate straits, and it was cold. And the blizzard was so intense that the snow blowed under our shirts and under our clothes, and melted, and our pockets blowed full. And you can't imagine the intensity of that blizzard, you know. Chief engineer, his legs were giving out because he'd never walked on snowshoes before, you know. And he tied some ropes to the toes to lift them up with his hand. And he came right along behind us, though, and we walked ahead of him, you know. Of course, that helped some because it left him something. He didn't have as much snow to tromp down as we did, although the tracks filled in just about fast we made them, you know. And we got to where I figured where it sloped down, and I knew the cliff was right there in front of us. So I crawled out easy to the edge of the cliff, and I had this one dog with me, you know. And I got out there on the edge, and I found a place where I figured I could push him over and probably hoped it wouldn't kill him. So I pushed him over the cliff. And we didn't know. About 20 minutes later, he come back to us, wagging his tail, tickled to death, see us, you know. And then I turned him around and told him to go, and he led us down the way he come back. And it was the place where I'd come up, because he'd been over it before, see, and he never forgot where he'd been. He was a leader.
And he found the trail for you then?
Yeah.
Oh, that's tremendous.
He came back to us, you know, and he knew how, he remembered that trail. He remembered that, and he went to it and came back up that trail, and then he knew where we was, and he came right back to us.
Well, that's
and then all we had to do, all I had to do was tell him, go ahead.
What was his name, Sam?
You Smokey.
Smokey.
I got pictures of him.
You got pictures of Smokey?
Yeah.
He was a real companion. He was a lifesaver, practically.
He sure was. He was a good dog.
Sure.
Those two guys, they thought the world of that dog.
So you sent him on down the trail then?
Yeah.
And you followed him?
Yeah.
And you went on down the cliff?
Yeah, we got to timber. We had to make timber, see? Because if we got stalled up there on that plateau where there's no timber, we were going to freeze to death that night, you know. We were going to chill to death. We couldn't possibly. We were wet from that snow drifting under our clothes, you know. The snow would drift under here, and I'd have a bulge in my shirt, you know, where the snow drifted under my shirt, and then it would melt and run down on your legs, you know. And oh boy, it was miserable. And we got a big spruce tree. I knew them spruce trees were there, and there was a great big one with limbs that come right down to the ground, interlocked into the wild hay. And I went under that with an axe, and I trimmed out some of the low limb, you know. And we had an igloo there that night. I got a picture of that, too. We had an igloo there that night that was absolutely windproof. And the wind was blowing. And we built a fire out front downwind. And the flames never got that high off the ground.
Never above a foot or so.
No, the wind blowed like mad. And the next morning, there was a big... We had nothing more to eat. With us. We had eaten up everything. And the next morning there was a flock of ptarmigan right in front. Oh, there must have been 10,000 of them. So the boss, he wanted to shoot them. He wanted to shoot the breakfast for us. I said, go ahead. He was a pretty good shot, you know. So he took his gun and he sneaked out there. But he didn't know just when to shoot. So he was wobbly on his feet, you know, from the exertion of the day before. So he pulled up his gun slowly. And just as he did, every ptarmigan took to the air. And down the creek went our breakfast.
Oh, wow. What did you do then?
Well, we weren't too bad off. We
We went about, we figured we'd get to the creek and we'd get a hold of something, deep grayling or something, you know. But we, the observing party had arrived right there opposite us that same day, same night we did. And we went about a mile, we come to their, about a half a mile, we came to their trail. And they had nothing but to eat with caribou meat. And they had lost 8 horses the night of the blizzard. They just run off into the void, you know, and they never see them again. We never even heard of them again. And then we lost 3 more horses before we got to the railroad. They just laid down, couldn't get up. We sacrificed them right there, put them out of their misery. Then I cruised the trail. We had to cruise an entirely new trail and stay in the timber, you know, where we could have fire and get something to eat. So we was eating caribou meat. We had one horse that would come to the campfire and he'd eat caribou steaks. Yeah, he'd eat them right now. He was the only horse that did. But he didn't make it. He died.
He did?
Yeah, he died for a couple of days later on the trail. It took us, I think, 5 days. We wasn't so awful far from the railroad. It took us,
Were they dying of starvation?
Yeah.
Or malnutrition?
Yeah. Starvation and overexertion.
They couldn't get to the grass and the graze under the snow.
The grass, there was so much snow. And we had four mules in the outfit. We had started out with 6, but 4 of them left. And the dog, of course, he was running down the trail, and he had a tail that curved up over his back, long brown hair on it, you know. And when he was running down the trail, that's all you'd see was that tail wagging, and the mules thought that was grass.
Uh-oh.
And they'd head for it, and they'd grab him by the tail.
Uh-oh.
And he would holler, you know, and I'd come running to the moose.